Mother Earth is pregnant for the third time, for y'all have knocked her up. I have tasted the maggots in the mind of the universe. I was not offended, for I knew I had to rise above it all or drown in my own shit.
All right, well, I wonder if anyone's going to show up.
Who said they were going to show up?
Well, I thought SJ was...
Hello.
Oh, there's Alex. Hey, Alex.
Hey. Oh, who's here?
Just me and Doug so far.
Okay. Well, I did not finish the book. I've got about 100 pages left. I've been reading it all day. But do my best here.
Yeah, last 100 are pretty good.
Yeah, it's hard to put down now. it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's hard to say. Oh, who's this? Dennis.
Yes, hi.
Hey Dennis.
Hey, yo.
You've been quiet, it's Dennis. Right. What have you been up to these days?
Oh, man. I don't know. I'm just really busy. Trying to do it. Trying to figure it out. No, but then my wife's also out of town this week for work, so I've had my hands full with the girls. And I'm not done with this book, but I'm over half, so.
Well, so did you listen to it?
Yeah, I did. But I haven't, I'm not done with that book.
Neither am I.
But so then if you're not, here's a question, like we're not doing the show yet, but when you're not listening to this book, is there something else that's more compelling that you are listening to?
You know, I just haven't been very diligent in I have, I don't know. Actually, it's funny you listed Vineland, and I'm a little bit into that one. But yeah, I don't know. Just more other podcast, other YouTube material, and I guess I am watching season 2 of Westworld again, but not out of not. Not with any like great, I don't know. I guess that's what I've been into. I've had a hard time staying in an audiobook lately.
All right, well, Lacey.
But it might just be summer. I don't know.
Well, I go through phases where I'm into something and then I put it down for a while and then I kind of have to force myself back into it.
Yeah.
Unless it's like a super binge.
Usually I'm good at the super binge, but I keep starting it too late. Like I went through several hours of Overstory the last two days, but I just didn't get there. But
yeah. I was reading. I was been reading it all day. Literally, basically, since I woke up.
Nice.
Still didn't finish it. So.
Yeah, awesome. But haven't you read it before?
No.
Oh, I thought you had.
Did you just start it today?
I started it like a week ago, and I read the first 100 pages or so. And I meant to just keep, because I started it early. I was like, alright, I'm going to read every day, and then shit happens and I just didn't get around to it, and so I tried to force myself today and I almost did it, but didn't quite make it. But I am happy to know that I can still sit and read a book for in a while.
Well, it's sad because in my 20s the internet was not very robust. It wasn't really anything. and I would read every single night before bed. And now, I don't know, I waste so much stupid time, like, you know, Facebook, Twitter, that kind of stuff.
Japanese pro wrestling.
Watch a little bit. Well, and then like 20 minutes of Netflix, and then like in bed on an iPad or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stupid. Well, we'll give Lacey 5 more minutes, and then we'll dive
just
into
got,
this.
Just got goats.
I haven't heard from him.
What's that?
Is SJ here? I see his face. I haven't...
Can you hear me?
Oh, there he is.
Hey. Hey there.
Sorry, I'm just in bed. I'm just waking up, so I'm just kind of laying down still. And, just tired.
You haven't changed countries on us again, have you?
No. I'm still in China, so still not in that one.
Nice.
And so then is it, I guess it's a little earlier than what we've done, but is it 11 a.m.-ish?
It's 10 a.m. But yeah, my schedule just changes a lot. I mean, my sleep schedule is kind of erratic, and it's fine. I'm glad to be up and be adding my 2 cents. So it's, but yeah, just kind of, I'm resting here. I gotta be teaching later today, so I'm just sort of
nice.
Low power mode.
Yeah, I'm in low power mode right now, just to kind of lay here.
Is it hot there?
It's okay. It's somewhat mild. I mean, from Texas compared to Texas, it's maybe about this. It's less hot, but there can be a humidity here. It's maybe a little bit more in Texas. Yeah. I'd say it's about 90 degrees Fahrenheit, like in the upper 80s, low 90s with humidity. So there's a typhoon that came through. There wasn't a direct hit, but it did hit near here. And this is like a typhoon zone. They said last year one came through and ripped up trees and stuff. It's kind of like a, I don't know, what the equivalent would be, maybe a Gulf Coast in America.
Yeah, that typhoon is on its way up here now.
Oh, shit.
Well, I don't know if it's going to directly hit or not, but it's wavy out in the beach.
Get down.
Which is fun.
Yeah. I've learned about the, by the way, the... some of my students are really, they're angry at China, at Japan. There's a huge rivalry.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I just found out kind of the hard way. Like, they bring it up, and I try to ask them, and they get emotionally triggered.
Yeah.
By the Japanese, Chinese, I guess, the history, you know.
Yeah.
In Taiwan, they all love Japan.
Oh, yeah.
That's it. And the Japanese and South Korean government hate each other, but the Japanese, younger Japanese, love South Korean culture. It's a weird dynamic all over the place.
Yeah, it's the same here. The younger generation love, or they're just more into Japan. They don't have these strong feelings. Yeah. I'm talking like late 40s or like right. Mid early 40s and up seem to have this really strong feeling. But the younger generation are very into Western culture, and I think maybe Pan Asia, the Pan Asian culture that probably has developed in the internet age, you know, with K-pop and these types of things.
Yeah, everybody loves K-pop.
KTV, or that's what they call karaoke here. Everybody does KTV. I've done it a few times. It's fun. But I think that's part of it too, maybe. The Japanese food, the cuisine, is also quite popular. How do they feel about China there, generally speaking?
Well, there's tons now of Chinese tourists. Like, there's Chinese tourists everywhere. And then... People just have this impression that Chinese tourists are dirty, loud and dirty and obnoxious.
I thought that was our job.
Yeah.
Well, they've taken the place of Americans.
It's the same as in Thailand. I mean, it's like the dirty Chinese tourist. And when I was in Thailand, I kind of felt the same way, because they are everywhere and they are loud. They can be loud, but here it's actually quite clean. I don't see that here, maybe because everybody except me is Chinese. You know, so you just sort of get used to it. But yeah, I'm aware of that reputation, for sure.
All right, I'm giving up on Lacey.
She's got goats.
She's got goats.
She's got goats.
She's getting my goat, I tell you what. All right. I will say, so let's talk about the game that Nile is making, because this is really interesting to me, because Bill McKibben is an environmental writer, and he wrote one of the first pop environmental books. It's called The End of Nature, maybe back in the late 80s when, you know, these activists were really getting underway. But in his newest book called Falter, he talks about life as a game. And so I found that really a strange coincidence that, you know, Nile was interfacing with the same kind of things where life is, especially in thinking about something that's really struck me lately is, I think, you know, it doesn't seem like our society is super religious until you realize that consumerism probably is our religion, and that the idea of worshiping growth and the, you know, the corporate gobbledygook that we just take in if you work in any kind of setting, you know, just whatever it is, the dogma that you're presented at your job that you're just supposed to. Like, if you step out of that worldview for a second, you realize, what the fuck is this? This is like theology. What is going on here? And so all of this is really interesting to me, this idea of the game. And, you know, like, just nature being, like,
There's that interview with Nile where he's describing the game that I thought was really good. I'm sure somebody remembers it better than me.
With the journalist?
Yeah, right.
He's talking on the phone with somebody.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he basically describes it as being like a, you know, various loops that just take up time. Didn't he say that? I think he said something to that effect.
He says something about being, the guy's like, aren't you worried that this is going to destroy the productivity of human beings? And he says, I think that's actually maybe not so bad of a thing to destroy productivity, which is kind of a interesting anti-consumerist, anti-capitalist sort of statement.
Well, Doug, you bring up a really interesting thing, actually, for me at least, this idea of religion and what are our religions. Because, I mean, I do think that there is an argument, and I'm certainly not, I'm for clean water, clean air, clean energy, you know, safe food, safe, like, all of that stuff, regulation, etc. But we do have kind of this, like, maybe a dogmatism around some of the environmentalism. It's even been called that. They call it alarmism, you know, and then it's accused on the other side, this kind of dogma of growth and, like, drill, baby, drill. And I think, like, our political moment is more religious than ever in just how people approach their worldviews. Like, we have the gods. I was thinking statism is a religion when you said that. I was going to throw that on the list. I know we have some anti-statists on the call. But, I mean, it's like we do. So much of this modern world is like, so much of our moment is what worldview will you adhere to? And then kind of putting on the trappings of that worldview that are very religious in a way. We have holy books, and I would even say scientific materialism is a, you know, to go there. People talk about that as the modern religion, It's like it's been replaced. Instead of the book of Genesis, you have the Big Bang as the origin story. You know, instead of like the prophets in the church, you have people like Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's like one of the, you know, one of the, I didn't mean to bring him up because of that hot tweet this week. He's like,
oh, I don't know. Right now. What is it? Okay. What is it?
But right after these recent spate of like shooting events, he had this really kind of insensitively timed tweet. I mean, you know, and where he said, like, you know, he went through all the numbers of people that die every day, and he was like, you know, more people, basically saying like this is a non-event because more people die from, you know, medical errors, I think was number one on his list. He was like, in the last week, you know, 300 people have died from medical ages. He went through and just sort of mocked during the height of the frenzy over these.
I think it was too logical is the thing. So he's just... You're trying to put some perspective on, like, statistics. Like, what if we looked at this recent shooting from, like, a statistical point of view? But it seemed misguided because it's like, so, like, medical accidents, like, we should try and prevent medical accidents, but, you know... It seems like
there's that part in the book where I forget who's saying it or where it comes up, but it's saying if we just followed reason, all trees would be rectangles. I mean, all forests would be rectangles, you know.
I love that part when it must be Dougie too, where he's driving and he wanders off to take a leak and he realizes that there's just a, what's it called, a something strip. Like a pretty strip?
We used to call them in BC the scenic fringe.
So the forest is decimated, but there's just a tiny little strip between the road and the decimation to give the appearance of pretty.
The Adam character, who's he ends up meeting these activists, forest activists, because he wants to study people whose viewpoints are so far out of the consensus viewpoint that they're righteous about a cause. They feel that they're right, even though it goes completely against what society believes. And at the beginning, as a psychologist, he's looking at that as a term, as a type of, basically, as a type of psychosis, right? Like, and there's a part in the book. It's like a person shouldn't be considered to be a schizophrenic if he holds values that are similar to society's values, right? so you can be as crazy as you want, as long as you correspond with what society believes. Then even clinically, you're not schizophrenic. You're not insane. And then there's another section in the book where it might be him again, and he realizes that from the point of view of this kind of natural intelligence or forest intelligence, whatever we want to call that, this kind of animal consciousness that separates itself from that is insane, you know? So all of human society, all of human civilization is insane from the greater viewpoint of this greater society. So that, I thought that was interesting point.
Yeah, and he's studying, often you hear religious people, you hear this same language, Nor. It's like, why are do people turn to religion for solace? What's the psychology of that? And he's studying these activists from that same model. It's almost like, why are they believers?
Yeah.
But then he went into the cathedral, you know, how many stories up, and then ended up, had his road to Damascus more. Yeah. His conversion. Because he's...
And his Judas moment, because he reverts back. It's like a moment of a lapse of... where he sets his beliefs aside in the thrall of Olivia. By the way, Olivia, like Mount of Olives, I think there's a connection there with her name and the olive tree and the religious connection. But yeah, sorry, Doug, but yeah, I for sure, for sure.
But yeah. Then there's also, so that, you know, even though they're trying so hard, there's just so much futility in all the action too.
Yeah.
It's hard to say, like, all the way through, there are these hints that there's a conspiracy of the Redwoods to create something, create something bigger to help them out. And, what they did, like the cell that they created, their eco-terror cell or whatever, it's like that was only a part of it. And even Olivia's shocked by it at the end when she dies. She was like, I didn't think it was supposed to end like this, you know? But you get the sense afterwards from dreams that Doug had and other people had, like Nick, I think also, that she realizes beyond the grave or wherever she is that it continues on, you know, they're still doing their part. And like even to the point where like Nick, he continues to do all this art. He ends up putting the whole the flip book of the chestnut tree, he ends up putting that on YouTube. Neely ends up seeing it on YouTube or somewhere online, and then he has another great vision. He said at that point he saw God, and then that's when he has the idea to create this whole other video game completely unlike Mastery, where the point is of the players is to create a world together, figure out how nature works together. And so the inspiration still continues. It's like this this idea all the way through the novel too, is like most of the stuff is happening underground in a forest, right? And I think that happens in the book as well. Most of the connections that are being made between these nine roots especially is really happening under the surface, and it's not so obvious. Like I was reading one critique of this book, I think it was in The Guardian or something, and this guy was saying everything is there. He doesn't the powers doesn't leave anything to the reader to figure out for himself.
Oh yeah.
He just gives us everything.
He really hated it. Yeah.
And then I just think it's complete bullshit. Like I think Powers must be laughing at him, you know. It's like, it's really what he's saying. It's like everything, most of what's happening is under the surface. The connections between all these people. And I keep rereading all these parts that I kind of marked off, you know, and seeing kind of more possible connections. I think it's a really deep book, actually.
I just had a note here. It's funny you mentioned that Guardian thing, Snor, because I haven't read that, but I have here in one of my notes, I feel like he tells and doesn't show Powers. And this is one of my criticisms. And I mean, I don't know if it's exactly, I don't think I'm saying what this gentleman is saying and the reviewer, but I just feel like there's some time it felt just sort of pedantic. Like when he goes into these explications of technology, I mean, we all live through that. I don't need to hear like a multiple page, maybe for 200 years, people can pick up this book and it could tell them something about that moment. But, you know, there's this like clunky explanation about like email. She logged in. Her new email address is like she could connect with people. It felt sort of childish in how he was telling us about the technology we've all used and understand how it kind of interfaces with our lives. And so, when I was saying earlier he was bending over backwards to kind of hit these high notes, I felt like some of the novel, especially towards the end, he went to these places and sort of just told us, because I felt like he maybe felt like he had to. Like the AI thing, like that's kind of, I know he has a whole nother book about AI, but it's like, then it's like, I felt like when I was, some of those sections with Neely, I was like, all right, now I have to hear the perfunctory, like AI simulation rant that we've all heard, and just hear him say it again.
His AI book is actually called Galatea.
Yeah, that's interesting, which is also from Ovid.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, my criticism, though, I mean, it didn't detract from the book necessarily. I was just wondering if that was his style, and I thought, well, maybe I need to read another book, too, to just see if he kind of has just I don't know what it was. I don't know what it was. I didn't feel like I was necessarily participating with the characters. So like with Don Quixote, I definitely felt there was this internal and external thing happening where I was like fully invested in, you know, both the inside of the action and kind of the outside as an observer. But with this book, I definitely felt like I wasn't necessarily participating with them. You know, I was kind of observing it, although I was invested. So it was interesting. It's a giant book of ideas. There's just, it's so much. So it could be really interesting to see, you know, like how something like that ages.
Well, yeah,
But then to agree with you a little bit, SJ, this was a book that I could drift off and not necessarily miss things. Like, you don't have to listen super close, because although what you're saying, Zenora, is that like if you think, yep, there's a trees all around me, you realize that the real action is happening underground and you do have to pay attention.
Yeah, I think he's writing on multiple levels. Like even the name of the book, right? Which I think we should get into what the title means, right? Like so in forestry terms, right? The understory. And he mentions that term, the understory, a few times in the book, and that means everything underneath the canopy, like growing on the ground of a forest, right? And then the overstory is the canopy itself, what's happening on top of the trees. But you get the sense in the book that he's meaning different things. Like the overstory is like the big story, which is maybe the human story. Yeah, it's so you have the understory, which is what's going on under the ground. This huge brain, like connected by all these fungal networks and root networks and everything else, and then on top of it you have these 200,000 year old upstarts, humans, having their own stories, right? And but these two things, the understory, the overstory, are linked, right? So the overstory, even though it's about these nine humans and the people that they interact with, it's also it seems to be a bigger thing, you know. It's how the understory has somehow been using us in a certain way, or using especially these nine people, but humanity in general, for a certain purpose. And it's hard to tell if it's like towards the end, Patricia mentions that life has gone through five different periods where the tree of life, she calls it, has almost fallen, right? Like life in general on Earth has almost died. And then the tree has always come back up, right? And so you get the sense that...
Well, that was the thing that I was talking about, where there's this overstory, the human story, but then there is this extinction that's happening, that the book is kind of talking about, like...
So you don't know, like... it's open, of course. Nobody knows, really, if the tree of life is going to succeed again with humans, or are we just a blip in the bigger story, right? And this is all related to Nile's game again, right? That, like, towards the end of the book, he's talking multiple times about the bots, right? The learners who are going around finding everything about everything. And I think I think that's why he's so focused on these things. Like he really has to talk about these things directly and clearly in a way, just to get them as part of the story. But he paints that as a possible way out, maybe, or it's maybe. Ultimately, it's all dependent on this other bigger thing.
I think it's important to mention Patricia Haverford. So she kills herself, right? She drinks poison, and she says, "This is the only solution: is this kind of human humicide, or what's the term for that?
She calls it an unsuicide at the end.
Yeah, so there's this, and I think that that is a.
But it's in line with their giving tree, and so like, what is she giving with that act? And I think we just spoiled it for Alex. Very sorry, Alex.
Well, that's just one of the little narratives, you know. But I mean, it just felt kind of religious in a way to me, because that's a talking point. You do have this. I mean, there are these talking points, and when I heard that scene, I was like, oh, not this, Richard Powers. Oh, come on, you give me a fucking break. But then Mimi, who's in the audience, she says kind of exactly what Zenora just mentioned. She's like, well, how do we know, right? We don't know. And so it actually problematized that suicide. Like, Powers wasn't saying humans should kill themselves because we're the big evil, that Earth would be a paradise but for these evil human beings, which I think you do get a lot of that, which is a talking point bordering on religion, of kind of the modern worldview, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Okay. But Mimi problematizes it. And I think that's an important point, at least for me, just setting aside the book, is that, and I'm glad he mentions it, but I mean, we don't know. We don't even know what history is. We don't even know where we've come from, right? And we have mainstream discourses, we have mainstream theories, we have alternative theories, but there is a big unknown about even what our story is. You know, what's the purpose of life? Who?
Yeah.
You know, and so I was happy that we saw that, a little bit of that injected, because this it was just wearing on me, that I felt like this novel was kind of just another liturgy in a modern religion, you know, in a way. So anyhow,
well, so go ahead. I felt like this was the antidote to the modern religion, like trying to return us to the garden. Which wasn't a garden. It was a forest. It was wild.
Yeah. The solution she suggests is to do nothing. You know, like how do you best restore a forest? Just do nothing. You know, stand back.
Right. Forest management. That's pretty ridiculous. It's funny because I think at the end of our last talks, Nora and I were talking a little bit, and we said like the 1 year when we didn't emit any carbon into the atmosphere was when the economy almost completely collapsed in 2008.
Like, I mean, you guys know about Agenda 21, right?
And this I've been waiting to bring this up. Okay, thank you. I'm sorry. I mean, I didn't want to be the one to do this. So,
well, I'm fine to go to these places because I don't really know. I mean, it's a relevant issue to you know, masticate upon. But I mean, yeah, like that's kind of one of the talking points. Like, let nature do nothing. Put the humans in these kind of zones of allowance, sort of like a Blade Runner reality. And you know, I mean, I'm not advocating this way of looking.
What did you call it? What was that?
This, like, you would no, let nature.
What, the, you had, what did you call
Blade
it?
Blade Runner reality.
No.
Agenda 21.
Oh, agenda.
Agenda 21.
I thought you were saying the Georgia Guidestones. Do you know those?
Agenda. Yeah, well,
that's relevant. Know, but... I mean, that would be kind of part of the same conspiracy theory, right? You know.
But I don't know. I get more and more impatient with these kind of things. You know, there's like I've been looking at this conspiracy shit for years now, like good decades now, and it just doesn't get anywhere. It's just like it leads people to paralysis, you know. It's like people don't want to do anything because they think they're following some fucking agenda that nobody seems clear on, and nobody in however many decades has really pointed out who is behind this, you know. It's like you just got to go to the beach, or you go to, yeah, you see these big clear cuts or whatever.
Really, there are specific people that have talked about agenda. I mean, Maurice Strong was a very specific person related to Agenda 21.
I'm not denying that any of this stuff is going on, and there's people using it in that way. You know, it's that, of course, we have to be conscious of that as well. But it's like if it gets to the point where we're just paralyzed by it, we don't do anything. Because we're afraid to fit into an agenda, we don't want to get the plastic out of the ocean or save the trees from getting cut down because we think we're gonna follow some agenda. You know, it's like then we're just lost. We've got to go with that consciousness that we have about these agendas in the background, and do it anyways. You know.
But this one, so it's an, I mean, we could have like a general conversation about conspiracy theory and like kind of the debilitating features of that. But I think this one is one that's actually got a lot of tangible, like documentation. And I'm not even call it, I say conspiracy theory. I don't even like that term. That we shouldn't even bring that up because I don't think it's relevant in this particular context in a way. I mean, there is a UN plan called Agenda 30, and they talk about their vision for the 21st century and beyond as an antidote to a lot of issues, including environmental problems and overpopulation, what they call overpopulation. And there are kind of plans for kind of managing population and even urban planning, you might call it. And so, I mean, this isn't something that,
this is actually
a very tangible policy recommendation.
I don't deny any of that. And I've been looking at that for years now, all those documents. And I really think, yeah, that's going on. Sure, it's going on in the background, but there are these other huge things, bigger things that are happening as well. And, this is what's been happening for the last, I don't know how many years, like at least the last 10 years or whatever, once we sort of just focus all our attention on finding where the tentacles of this thing goes and nothing else, and we're afraid to do anything because we're afraid that we're going to help it along, you know? We're falling for Hal's bluff, you know? That's what I call it. It's like Hal from 2001, where he convinced Frank that he was about to win the chess game, and he wasn't. Hal just lied, you know. It's the they paint themselves as omniscient and omnipotent, and there's obviously something bigger than the conspiracy or whatever you want to call it, you know.
Obviously, but I see it a little bit differently. I see the complacency is more at risk for those individuals who are kind of unwilling to entertain an examination of tentacles. I find people that are the most like ardent activists in a lot of cases are the so-called people that are impugned with that label. They're people that don't buy certain foods because of the toxins, for example. Like the organic food movement that grew up so rapidly was because of what Monsanto would call conspiracy theorists, right? And they're even called that today. You have this conspiracy theory that eating food that's infused with Agent Orange or what, that's not the term for it. What's the
glyphosate?
With Roundup.
Yeah.
Glyphosate. That you should do that. And if you don't, you're a conspiracy theorist. Those folks are actually taking a robust action all over the world. Some of the most ardent activists. Vaccines are another example. I just think there's maybe a counter argument and maybe some good counter examples that show that this kind of questioning analysis is actually more prone to the kind of actions that I think you're alluding to, Znor. And I think the risk on the other side is that people kind of passively are just herded by these kind of planners, central planners, because they just say, well, anyhow, those are some of the things I'm thinking of. I wasn't even expecting this kind of little debate here.
Well, I sort of was in a way, you know, because these are the sorts of things that the book opens up, and I think it's good to get into this, you know.
Yeah. Me too.
I hear what you're saying. I just don't think that the book itself is advocating that sort of centralized action of things.
The book could be advocating just time running its course, or like this is the moment. I don't even know if it's advocating anything.
I would say that there's a kind of, it's not, I wasn't too annoyed by it, but there is a definite sort of kind of lean towards communist thought, which kind of made me laugh and made me think of Yuznor, knowing that you're an avowed communist.
He's an anarchist.
Communist anarchist.
Are you
anti-statist? I was referring to him earlier as an anti-statist.
there's some passages about
I'm a Kropotkin fan.
Right. There's passages about like the it's when Adam is watching the ants and talking about how they have a sort of there's an unspoken everyone has their place kind of attitude that seemed somewhat very loving. I could tell. I mean, I just know that Richard Powers is probably a dirty commie.
Well, so that's really interesting, because the person that McKibben trots out as like the bad guy for his book in Falter, his latest book, is Ayn Rand. And he basically blames where we're at now politically on her, like these really strangely misguided notions of selfishness as like some kind of principle that are not based in any form of reality. He's like,
and you could see that also in Nele's game, where he kind of creates this world where it's a very capitalist sort of world where everybody's trading and pursuing their own interests and creating their own thing. And then he has that encounter with the guy when he's doing his research, and the guy's like, this place kind of sucks. I thought it was going to be better than the RL real life, but it's not. And I guess I haven't gotten to that part, but that's when Znor said that he decides to create a new game that's where everybody works together. I was like, there you go. That's the communist vision.
Well, they remove him from his role too. I thought that was funny. It's like, that's his ultimate defeat, you know, when he has this leap of inspiration, he gets kneecapped.
Even better. His
subordinates
say, you shouldn't do that. But it's like, whether, I don't know, you call it communist or what, you know, he's talking about mutual aid.
Yeah,
you know?
That's the problem and, I have with
this
that.
This is a strain within anarchism all the way back, you know, to Proudhon and before, you know. It's like, he's not talking about a centralized action at anywhere throughout the book. He's talking about this networked, system, totally decentralized, totally distributed, and so like if you want to call that communist, maybe I'm okay with that. But most people, what they think of as communists, they think of Stalin and the Soviet Union, this sort of top down, centralized model, which is not. I think this book is completely against that sort of idea. You know, it's all about like literally grassroots action, you know?
Okay, I'm going to jump in here because I disagree with that. I think actually, and I want to go back to this point that, and this is fun, by the way, I'm awake. I'm getting ready for I've got energy now. But see, I see that this is the nature of propaganda, right? This is how the best propaganda works. And I'm not claiming, we're having a conversation here, but let's assume for a second that Richard, this book is propaganda, okay, for a statist, environmental, authoritarian, 21st century crackdown, okay, and I think that this is how the best propaganda works, right? It's like what you do
he speaks for the trees, right?
Yeah. Well, you make it so that the underlying rationale is actually reified, supported, undergirded. So what I mean, the underlying rationale of the people in our world that are advocating for these kind of status authoritarian in the name of environmentalism, aka Agenda 30, whatever you want to call it, all right, I think we see that with these talking points that he's clearly agreeing with, of like nature is the grandmother, humans are a threat, we need to kill humans effectively. That I mean, that is reified. That is the second thing is that in the book it's actually implicit that the state would be the kind of rescuer through these regulations, through the courts, right? I mean, the idea is the courts would kind of come to their senses, and then we would use the power of the courts to kind of reform, at least at some point in the book, this is at least advocated for with the vegetable character.
There was,
you know, the state could be this. Yeah, he would have the Ray Brinkman, right? So I just think that this is it. I'm not saying that that's what this book is, but I do think it makes me a little wary, at times. Just when I hear some of this stuff, I'm like, no, you're gonna do this. Like, this is just lockstep in line with what I think is some kind of political religiosity of like a statist democratic party. You know, these are talking points that like greenwashing. Corporations use these talking points to greenwash. You know, I mean, these oil companies are saying the exact same thing. This could be like an oil company brochure. You could read parts of this novel and how they're going to save the world, and they're part of the solution. So I don't know. I mean, I just don't think it's as clear as you feel about it, Snor, that this is not advocating those things. And I think there's some danger in what this book is, at least some of the ideas that Richard Powers seems to agree with. Not that Powers is advocating these authoritarian solutions, but that in our own world, people are using those same ideas as part of their...
People at the top are using the opposite ideas to further their power as well. Like anti-environmental ideas are... They work on both sides, you know?
Yeah.
It's like... I think that's a... It's kind of a wrong way to think of it, like just to sort of focus on how not to get sucked in. You know, it's like we've got to read something like this or read literature in general and go beyond any agenda, try to at least, and look at whatever truths there are there that we've experienced ourselves, right? And of course they have to be challenged. You know, we have to challenge our own experiences, our own senses, everything else, right? But I think in art or in literature, you know, there's something beyond these sort of power agendas, you know?
In the best literature. And I would put this in that category. I think this is not a Borges. This is not the kind of highest form of art, which does exactly what you're describing.
I don't know if it is either. You know, it's like obviously there's not a character in it, like Doug said, like a Don Quixote. Or you don't read characters like Shakespearean characters in this. It's not the same standard of literature. But
I think our perspective is gone, though. Is the
just
problem.
Like very, very few recent books are, you know, but it's like, but it is possible to read a book like this and to get something deeper out of it, you know. It's like, than just political agendas, you know. Like he's not really talking about that. He's talking about the natural world, you know. It's like. In our relationship with the natural world.
What I said at the beginning, it still applies to me. Like the 20 pages, and there is like 20 solid pages in there. There would be a wonderful chapbook that is like these beautiful ideas. All right. I do feel like there's a lot of fat in this book that does go into political agendas that I think you could cut out. And so, I mean, I think we're in largely agreement, actually, Snor. I just think we feel differently about how much is worth keeping in the book and like where are those kind of moments where this work of literature rises to something that's quite redeemable. And
but what
and,
you're throwing and, away is the whole world. Like in some essence, what he's doing is capturing the natural world and our interaction with it.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Well, then we just throw away all movies and all books. Just burn everything.
Well, he's not. He, I don't know where you're getting.
I mean, what if you go back to the natural world? You know? Yeah.
he's like all the way through. He's hearkening back to literature and like human culture all the way through. I don't get the sense that he wants to throw at any of that. You know.
Well, so nature, right?
I don't either. I don't either.
Yeah, go ahead, Dick.
Well, so we think of nature as separate from ourselves, right? Because we've kind of isolated. So we clear a little place on the ground, and we put our domiciles, and then we, you know, cut all the trees down, and there's no bugs necessarily right there, and so, you know, there's nature out there, and there's us right here, but this is just more of a integration of that, where you know he's erasing that illusory line that, you know, there is no line where we stop and where nature begins.
He's trying to point out that there's an intelligence in nature. Like we are all so focused on finding intelligent life outside of Earth, and it's here. You know, it's like we spent a fraction of the resources we spend trying to get towards space, you know, on like, I don't know, trying to communicate with trees, you know, what would come up, you know?
Yeah, you know, I think the reason that I'm attracted to the understanding of how the technical pages that SJ speaks about, like, if we internalize those, I think humans can operate on that same level, which I think is pretty transformative. So maybe a McKenna type solution in a certain way. But it's worth it. It's worth
it. I just want to mention that this book won the Pulitzer Prize, won the National Book Award, shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. That doesn't happen unless a book is politically expedient for the times, mm-hmm. I would say. And I would say that this book is absolutely that, in a whole manner of different ways. And I share SJ's deep suspicion of the underlying intentions in media, in mass media. But I also sympathize with Znor for saying that that is not in the slightest bit all that there is in this story. I mean, if it's there, but I think it's, I was sort of refreshed at least to think that, like, something, I don't know, I read this book and I just had this, I've had this extreme emotional response to it and this deep human feeling for these characters and things that has just made me think and reflect on my life and memories and people I've lost and trees I've lost. And I think that's what matters. And I think that's what we're saying about how we read art and literature, isn't it? And I see both sides of this every day, of everybody just reducing movies and books and things to their political messaging, and declaring things evil because, you know, they're leftist or whatever, or the other side too. Absolutely, definitely, both sides do that. And so I mean, there's a deeper conversation to be had, but it's also good to, you know, mention it and talk about it because it's there. And I mean, I think I wouldn't go, I mean, yeah, well, I'm going to finish my thought just there. I said everything I wanted to say.
And let me just be clear. I mean, I wasn't trying to reduce the work to only that this is like a piece of propaganda, you know, ghost written by some, you know, big corporate entity,
which is absurd.
Which is insane. I wasn't trying to reduce. I was just bringing this into the table, one seat of many seats, right? And I mean, I you know, because it is part of this conversation.
Well, I mean, yeah,
it has to be part of the conversation. And I do think there's redeemable, transcendent features to this literature. I do. I was moved by my favorite story, I will say, is this idea of the Christ-like woman who's the general and the spiritual leader simultaneously. And that part of the story really sucked me in. And the love story with Nick, the artist, kind of falling in love with, I mean, that just, I felt like that was really well done. I just want to be clear, I'm not reducing it to this political agenda, but we have to include it in the conversation. So.
Yeah, I totally agree with that as well. I think that is a deeper level to it. But as Alex was saying, I think there's even a deeper level, a much deeper level than that as well, which I don't know if we've even really scratched the surface of that kind of deeper level, you know, which is the... our relationship to nature, our relationship to trees. Like, all of these characters had a relationship, individual relationship with a particular tree, and that changed them. In the same way that Powers, in his own like conversion story, he had the experience with the big tree he met in the Santa Cruz Mountains. You know, it's like To me, that seemed to be the deepest thing in the book. You know, whether or not it's great literature or not, that will come in the future. You know, it will. But that in itself is the most meaningful thing in the book. Is when I read that book, I started to think of my own relationships with trees. You know, with trees, with nature in general, and how I have had those kind of transformative experiences with nature. Those things are harder to talk about because they're deeply personal, you know?
Yeah, Zanor, you linked to an article that talked about each character being an avatar of, I haven't read it yet, but I'm curious if you have more to say, because I think like we are simultaneously linked to things in different you know, mineral kingdom, you know, I think we are these things simultaneously, like we're different layers. That's a really curious avenue. You kind of touched on it already, but do you have more to say? I haven't read the article yet, but
the article, she was a woman saying that she had found this kind of subtext in the book, which I was kind of wondering about as well. Towards the end of the book, Ray Brinkman and his wife, and Ray's like, of course, he's had a stroke; he can hardly speak, and they decide to just let their acre and a half backyard go wild, like grow into a forest. And one of the trees that starts to grow in there is a chestnut, and they're wondering how the hell is a chestnut growing here? Nobody planted it, and then Ray, for some reason, starts saying, "Our daughter, there was a seed in the paper cut in a paper cup, and our daughter planted this seed in the backyard." And then his wife is like, "What? We don't have a daughter. We haven't been able to have kids." And then she thinks, "Ah, he's making up a story for me in the same way that I've been reading stories to him for years now." But this woman who wrote the article said that the daughter that they sort of create together after that, this sort of fictional daughter, sounds a lot like Olivia. And so her theory, this woman's theory, is that in the same way there are avatars within Nile's games, humans that have avatars who are like trees or gods or whatever, the trees have created an avatar of Olivia, and then maybe Olivia, coming back from the dead after she had an accident, was actually an avatar of a tree. You know, like she. I don't know. I don't totally go along with this theory, but there is something to it. You know, in the description at the end where they talk about their fictional daughter, this daughter has this tattoo on her shoulder, and. It says that Olivia also had a tattoo on her shoulder.
Scapula.
On her scapula, yeah.
It makes sense that she would come back as a chestnut, too, because of her relationship with Nick.
Yeah.
Meeting him and the last chestnut in the country or so forth.
Yeah.
And the legal idea that the tree should have protection like humans, according to the law. Ray Brinkman was working on this legal theory.
Yeah, and her father was a lawyer. Like, you don't hear much about her father, but her father was a lawyer. That's one thing I thought, which is different than the sort of like mainstream narrative these days, is that all the way through there's a kind of a strong role for the father, you know, which you don't see that so much in mainstream culture, you know. So if I was to ask Powers a question, I'd ask him about that, you know.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, for sure. All the way through, even the Chinese character who had his strong father at the beginning, he then became a strong father.
Sort of the cliche kind of like nature worship thing is it's all about the mother, but in this book it's mostly about the father. You know, you don't hear much about the mother.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, one of the characters is a woman who can't be a mother. Mm-hmm. The three girls, when they're just totally it's about their father. When their father dies, you don't even like hear anything about their mother.
Yeah. Well, she has like dementia or something. Right?
She goes crazy. Yeah.
Right, which is kind of like, but she just leaves the story. I mean, there's she plays no real role.
Like none of the women in the book are mothers really, except these sort of shadowy mothers of the characters that you don't hear much about. Mimi has a very close relationship with her father, and
maybe that
Trisha,
is a
and,
way of saying, you know, that we're what humans are doing to Mother Nature is like erasing it, kind of through the deforestation and so forth. That's kind of the attitude towards the mother energy.
Yeah.
I saw even the males take pictures. It's a patrilineal art project that it gets passed down only from man to man.
Right, yeah, that's true.
And the man carries that seed, I guess, that that's a really interesting insight. Wow.
And the scroll that Mimi has, it's all like Buddhist arhats who are all male as well. Mm-hmm. Having this right on the verge of enlightenment.
And the man cracks down on the main characters at the end. Adam.
Yeah.